Welcome back to the MJA podcast. I'm Kate Swanell. The word on everyone's lips right now is coronavirus, and my special guest today is one of Australia's leading infectious diseases experts. At the time of recording this intro, Australia had 74 confirmed cases, including 3 deaths. Professor Alan Cheng is Director of the Infectious Prevention and Healthcare Epidemiology Unit at Alfred Health in Melbourne. He's taken time out of what is a very busy schedule to talk to us about how COVID-19 may behave in Australia and what we can do to protect ourselves and patients. Is it inevitable, do you think, that we are going to get more community transmitted cases and that this is going to take off here?
Those two are not necessarily always go together. So I think it's inevitable we will get community cases just with the increasing number of cases around the world. Someone will get in and there will probably be some community transmission. Mm-hmm. But whether it takes off or not is actually another question. And that really is sort of very dependent on how good we are at detecting the cases. So mm-hmm. if we can find them and isolate them early, and even if there's a few transmissions and we can get on top of that early, then we can sort of minimise the amount of transmission from those cases. And I think, there's quite a drumbeat of bad news going around at the moment. But I think, some of the countries that actually have had quite a lot of cases, just in mid-February, are actually doing quite well. So, and we don't tend to notice those when we hear all the other countries. But, for example, Singapore and Hong Kong really haven't actually reported that many cases in the last couple of days. And that suggests that they're, that sort of extreme public health, where they're able to really search down every case and look at all their contacts, and so it does seem to work. There's always the question about how possible that might be in Australia, but it is certainly possible.
You talked about early detection. What is the situation here with testing? For example, if I'm a GP and a patient walks into my office and is showing things consistent with COVID-19, what do I do next? Is there a test in my drawer I can pull out and do?
Sort of. So the first thing, if you have someone that fits that description, particularly someone that's come back from overseas and you're worried that they've got it, is to make sure that you and they are safe. Obviously, if they're really unwell, you might have to send them to hospital. But if they're not too unwell, then make sure you put on a surgical mask yourself and the appropriate personal protective equipment, so mm-hmm. eye protection and gloves and gowns and so on, and use your hand hygiene. To do a test, it's for GPs, it's ordered through their normal pathology provider. So they should have some swabs available. Ideally the flock swabs, which are the sort of new ones that we use for viral testing. And you can, the best specimen is sputum, but recognising most people don't produce sputum on demand, then a nasal swab is probably the best specimen that you can send off to the lab. There's a lot of sort of innovative ways that I've seen people try and keep themselves safe and to try and make it most efficient. And obviously these may not be suitable for all GPs, but one is if the patient has called in before, meeting them in the car park or setting up a little sort of, stand in the car park might be one option. If sputum, particularly, send them to collect the sputum specimen outside is another thing that people have suggested. Again, it might not work for, if they're on the 10th floor of an office building, then obviously that's not going to work. But I think it's just a matter of thinking through, what would you do if someone fronted up to your practice with.
Is it worth like an isolation waiting room, for example, having a separate room available for people who you might have a high index?
I think at this stage, people are unlikely to see, a lot of patients all at once that need testing. And I think probably the best strategy at this stage is really just to find the room that you would put them in and then close the door. The other thing is also to make sure that reception staff and people are sort of at the front meeting the patients, there's signage about to say, if you've come back from overseas, can you come up, and rather than just sit in the waiting room and wait. So just identifying people that might have COVID is important.
South Korea's hit the headlines a bit, not just because they've had a huge number of cases. They've had a huge number of cases because they're testing pretty vigorously. Mm. Is that a possibility here? I mean, it's a different society, a different culture. Will Australians put up with being tested on the street?
I think that just to be tested, it's a very unusual situation in, in South Korea. It's sort of spread through a religious community, and which can make it sometimes easier and sometimes harder with public health interventions. They're certainly doing a lot of testing. I think that there are commercial assays that are coming out to test for the SARS coronavirus too. And once they're online, our capacity to do more tests would be better. At the moment, it's probably a little bit constrained. We couldn't certainly do those numbers today, but probably in a couple of, in a week or two, there should be a lot more capacity.
There's a lot being said in a lot of different outlets about how dangerous this is. Let's try and get some facts out there. How does this rate in terms of transmissibility, in terms of, for example, comparing to, say, SARS or MERS or even the flu?
It's actually quite a difficult question because, so we talk about R0 being the reproductive number of an infection. So if it's more than one, and you, if every case produces more than one infection, then an outbreak takes off.
Yep.
If it's less than one, then it tends to extinguish. It actually is quite difficult to work out what it would be if it came to Australia. So because R0's not sort of like a fixed biological property, it's very context specific. So, you know, Wuhan presumably is, you know, a relatively crowded Chinese city. At the start of the outbreak, they didn't even know that they had, you know, it was a new pathogen and no one had recognised it, so there probably wouldn't have been much infection control.
Yes.
And then the usual infection control, the activities of the people that got sick and so on, was not, it may well be different in Australia than it would be in a big Chinese city. So the estimates that have been put out of, you know, 2.5 or 3 or it is probably higher than it would be in many other places.
Yeah.
And then with control measures that have been brought in China, and then the control measures we would use in Australia or in other countries, the effective reproduction rate is going to be lower. So we don't really know sort of what it's, you know, what its behaviour would be in other countries at this stage. It does look, you know, just from sort of those figures that have been estimated in China, it does look like it is more infectious than flu. So even swine flu and pandemic flu would have a reproductive rate of 1.8 or 2. So it's going to be more than that. And seasonal flu is sort of, you know, 1.2 or thereabouts. You know, how amenable it is to control is not quite as clear.
I'm talking with Professor Alan Cheng about COVID-19. The MJA has new research available on mja.com.au from both Australia and China, and we are updating that information as often as we can. If you're enjoying this podcast, why not leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your pods? Back to our chat. What are we talking about in terms of treatments specifically? Do we know what's working and what's not yet?
No, in general, steroids are generally been, you know, we tried it basically for every new disease, and assuming that the immune response can sometimes be part of the problem rather than the solution. In general, it's thought that previous coronaviruses, so SARS and MERS coronaviruses, aren't responsive to steroids and, in fact, sometimes can make things worse. So if it was to be tried for this coronavirus, then it would have to be carefully trialled and you'd want it as part of a study rather than just to give it. In terms of other treatments, actually, there's a number of trials that have, one is completed and one is in progress at the moment. So one treatment that was talked about earlier was lopinavir, which is an anti-HIV medication, and that has some activity against coronaviruses. So that trial actually has, as I understand, finished in China, and we're expecting the results in the next couple of weeks. So they just have to wait for the follow-up of these patients and then they'll have results fairly quickly.
Yep.
The other trial of remdesivir, which was an antiviral that was proposed for Ebola, but also has activity against coronaviruses.
Does that suggest that this will burn itself out?
I think it's too early to tell. So within China, the sort of public health measures that they've been taking have been pretty extreme.
Yes.
Things that you know, we probably wouldn't be able to do in Australia. But I think that, you know, the question really is what is going to be sustainable in terms of, you know, the population will abide by them and will allow the economy to function without sort of opening the floodgates again to new infections. And it probably is going to be something, some model of, you know, contact tracing and case finding and so on that would be possible. But whether that's enough is still an open question.
Is this something that really only the hospitals and infectious diseases folk need to be worrying about? Does Joe Public need to be thinking, holy crap, I shouldn't be going to shopping centres or sporting events or shaking hands with people? Are we at the point where the public need to be doing things to protect themselves?
I think if this comes, then everyone's going to have a part to play. You know, obviously, healthcare workers are going to have a lot to do taking care of everyone. GPs are going to have a really important role. It's, you know, managing people that don't need to be in hospital and disseminating good advice and so on. But in terms of the public, I think there are things that can be done. So, you know, every little bit probably helps a bit. So, you know, we talk about personal hygiene, and in the context of, you know, a single person washing their hands, it might not seem to be a lot, but at a population level, if everyone does it, then it can have sort of more of an effect. I think at this stage, it's about sort of what's appropriate for the time. So, obviously, the New South Wales case, they're investigating at the moment. But, for example, I'm in Melbourne. We don't think there's any transmission going on here. There's been thousands of negative tests, so we're relatively confident that there's not a lot of transmission going on, at least out in the community. So I wouldn't necessarily change anything that I'm doing just at the moment. But looking forward to a few weeks, it is probably worth trying to get into good habits of not touching your face and washing your hands. But of things, because when this comes, it will happen. I think one of the questions, there's a couple of questions I'm always asked, is about face masks. And clearly, at the moment, there's probably no use in wearing face masks because there isn't any COVID around. But in general, it's probably not a lot of not good use of masks for the public to wear them. It's the way we use them in hospitals is really for sort of defined contacts with known patients.
Yes.
Whereas in trying to wear them for long periods of time, they get damp. They don't really work all that well, and then they're pretty uncomfortable. Probably isn't really useful, and it's probably much better to try and wash your hands and so on. The other question is about sort of stockpiling food, and I just saw the toilet paper has vanished from the supermarkets today.
Yes.
I think, you know, one of the public health measures that can be requested is for people that get sick, or if someone in their household is sick, to self-isolate or self-quarantine for 2 weeks. Those measures would be used under specific circumstances if they were thought to be useful. But if that was to happen, then it probably is worth having, you know, a couple of weeks worth of toilet paper and food and other things. And, you know, recognising that, you know, now we have online shopping and I think it's not, you know, totally cut off from the world.
Yes.
But I don't think you really need to prepare for the zombie apocalypse or anything at this stage.
Do we need to be keeping a special eye on our elderly relatives, for example?
Yeah, they do seem to get more unwell. I think that, you know, aged care, nursing homes and so on need to be to have plans. And they're usually pretty well practiced from gastroenteritis outbreaks and other things that can occur in nursing homes. And this would be sort of treated the same as an influenza outbreak or a gastro outbreak. I think that for families, I think one thing to think through is, you know, if your relative and if they do get sick, what do you need to do? How do you look after them? How do you make sure that they're okay? Deliver food to them and so on, and get them to a doctor if they need that.
What's the story with kids, Alan? Because they don't seem to get it.
Yeah, that's an interesting phenomenon that has been noticed in previous coronaviruses, coronavirus outbreaks. So in SARS and MERS, it does seem to be less kids are involved than you would expect from their proportion of the population. In the Chinese figures where they've reported, you know, 40,000 cases, there are actually very few kids involved, a couple of hundred, I think, under sort of 10, and then a few more in teenagers. And kids don't seem to get very severe disease.
Is this about comorbidities, do you think?
There's a couple of possibilities. So one is maybe the kids don't get infected at all, and there's something about their physiology or something about them that makes them relatively resistant. So one possibility is that the receptor for the coronavirus to get into the body is the ACE2 inhibitor receptor. And if that's different in children than it might be in adults, then that's one possibility as to why they might get infected.
Okay.
The other possibility is they do get infected, but they just don't get sick. That obviously has a big implication for public health. So if they don't get infected, we don't need to shut schools. But if they do get infected a lot, but just transmit it, but don't get sick, then, you know, that makes it a bit more difficult. That might be because of things like smoking, or so cigarette smoke. Kids don't usually smoke. And in China particularly, the smoking prevalence is relatively high.
Yeah.
Or it might be things like comorbidities. But I think the pattern of comorbidities that we're seeing in the elderly are more suggestive of they're the comorbidities you get at that age rather than these are the comorbidities that give you severe disease.
what's your priority for the next couple of weeks?
So it's been a little busy. So I'm helping some of the public health authorities with reviewing the epidemiology and sort of trying to make sure that national policy is consistent. Mm-hmm. So there are public health guidelines for units, and they're trying to get prepared as to what might they do in different circumstances. Then at a hospital level, we're working through different scenarios. So what if we had one extra case? What if we had 10 extra cases? What if we had 100 extra cases? Yeah. And then sort of working out, well, where would we put patients and what do we need to ask our intensive cares or our respiratory units to do to look after that, those different numbers of patients. So, we don't really know what's going to happen, but we just need to think through what would we do in different scenarios if the need arose.
Thanks, Alan.
Well, thanks very much.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.